an audience that claps beforehand.
I'm not going to read this, but I need it later. It's always an honor and a privilege to talk at an AA meeting, and I want to thank Billy for asking me. I took my last drink on December 23rd, 1967. You'll note that I didn't say that was my sobriety date. I had to do all of the 12 steps before I became sober. And, you know, I had a lot of dry periods, different periods after automobile accidents and things like that during my drinking days. And I'd never been more uncomfortable than those days when I was dry without a program. In order to feel, I was a daily whiskey drinker. I was a barroom drinker, although I kept a bottle under the seat. And, of course, I had booze at home. I was single. That's enough on the dry thing and the sobriety thing. I also used my last name. I'm not breaking any of the traditions, I don't think, by doing that. 12th tradition says anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. I use my last name because I'm a citizen of the United States. I can do what I want. I can't violate, and I don't let my name be printed in a paper, so I'm not violating Tradition 11, which is our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We should always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Now, AA had the benefit of not doing what the Washingtonians did. The Washingtonians were formed about 1840 in this country. Very successful temperance organization. Did a lot of good, but they didn't have anonymity, and they didn't have the ninth tradition, which is an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest the problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Those days they didn't have radio and films, but they did have newspapers. And when speakers who became popular in the Washingtonians would arrive in a town, they'd actually print in the paper. Whole town would turn out. That was their only form of entertainment. And that was fine, because they may pick up some new recruits. But then some of the foremost speakers would get drunk. That ain't good press then. Then the Civil War came along, and, you know, they got divided in that. And that's the nice thing about AA. We don't talk politics in here. Hopefully we don't do business in here. And I like it that way. We're here for one thing, singleness of purpose. That's enough of my little sermon. My sponsor told me one time I shouldn't give a sermon. I'll just tell you that story. I was sober long enough to be talking, okay? I would give talks. And my sponsor was Lou Sherwood. He's deceased. Great guy. He got sober 7 years before I did, and he spent all those 7 years preparing to become my sponsor. He was married to Margaret. She was in the program. And this particular evening, I was supposed to talk with them. I forget who was going to lead and who was going to speak other than me. But I had had this horrendous argument with my then wife. And I thought maybe that once you're sober, none of those kind of things ever happened. And I mean, I was really shook up and nervous and everything else. I was beside myself. So I called Lou and I says, I can't make it tonight. He said, why not? I says, I'm not qualified to talk. He says, you an alcoholic? I says, yeah. He says, are you drinking? I says, no. He says, you're qualified. So I start with this big explanation, you know, about this traumatic event, you know. And he said, wait just a minute, Free. He had a way of cutting through all of the baloney that I tried to do. He says, you know, when you give an AA talk, you're not supposed to give a sermon. He said, if you've had a shitty day, tell him that. He says, I'll see you at 7 o'clock. that's the way it went. He was good on other things, too, while I'm on sponsorship. And, boy, if you don't have a sponsor, get one. After Lou, I had 20-some years, I think, when Lou died. And I thought I didn't need a sponsor for a while. Well, I got one now. And, you know, I've been dry 41 years. I don't know how long I've been sober. But I recommend it. Anyway, I'm the kind of guy today, and I was even worse when I was new, that if you push me and order me around, I push back. I don't like the people telling me what to do. And that's why I like AA with all their suggested steps. Suggested, but you better do it. Right. Anyway, with Lou, he kind of had me figured. He couldn't push me around. So when I would come out with some crazy idea about what to do on some sort of a thing in my life, he'd say, well, Dave, that might work for you, but if it was me, and then he'd lay it out. He didn't tell me I had to do it or anything else. Gave me the opportunity to think about it overnight, and the next morning I'd adopt it as my very own idea. And, you know, hey, great. We're a devious bunch here at AA. Okay, well, I had my first drink. You're supposed to tell how it is or how it was, what happened to get us to AA, and how it is now. I had my first drink and my first drunk on the same day I was 12. That's pretty young. I came from a teetotaling family. Nobody in my family drank. Now, there was a lot of alcoholism on my father's side. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My uncle was an alcoholic. My aunt. Everybody on that side of the family was an alcoholic. But my dad had passed this moral judgment on an amber fluid, and he didn't drink at all. And my mother was a Quaker, so she didn't do anything, believe me. In fact, I think one of the reasons I was attracted to the fun we have drinking is that things seem kind of grim around our house. I saw drinking in other homes and a lot of laughter and music and dancing and all that stuff they didn't do in my house. Anyway, that's not an excuse. But I know that I just was born to be an alcoholic. All I needed to do was drink. I have the genes. I believe in that. I believe that it's a genetic thing. I know they've had a lot of different studies, whether it was environmental and all this other stuff, and I don't want to get into that kind of a discussion. But it's a pretty well-known fact. All you need to do is look, and you can see that alcoholism runs in families. And so I think that, I'm just destined to become one. The amazing thing is that I don't know what time, it was 1941 when Jack Alexander's article came out in the Saturday Evening Post about AA. And it was one of the first big articles. And there was a big influx of people coming into AA, or at least inquiring about it. And I can remember my parents talking about that in the kitchen. Well, I was born in 1928, 1941. How old would I have been? You know, not very old, 12, 13. And, but I remember that. So maybe I was also destined to go to AA. The amazing thing is that in listening to discussions in my family with my grandparents and my immediate family, my relatives and so on, other than the ones on my father's side, I got the notion that an alcoholic was some sort of subspecies. I can remember overhearing them talk. My grandparents had a home with an outhouse. There was a big grate above the stove that heated the second floor. And I was supposed to be in bed, but I'm down there listening, you know. I could even look down there and see their heads and everything. And I was listening to them one night, and they were talking about Faye McGee. Well, Faye McGee was the town drunk where I grew up, this little town where my mother was born, northeastern Pennsylvania. And I don't know, I just got the notion that Faye wasn't too much. So Danny Dunham and I thought it would be okay to light matches in his shoes when he was passed out in the doorway. Faye didn't wash regularly, didn't have a steady job, found him in odd places in the morning. He was fair game for us kids, okay? What I didn't realize was I was going to grow up and be another Faye McGee in a little different financial strait. And believe it or not, when I was finally forced to go to AA by a spouse, and believe me, I was only going to dodge in here and get the heat off, that's all. Now, give you an idea of my condition. I started when I was 12. I was a regular barroom drinker by the time I was 15. The big book says that alcoholism is but a symptom, and I agree with that. They also say that any definition of alcoholism without including the physical side, which I call genes, that's also incomplete. Anyway, what was I talking about? Does anybody know? Huh? Oh, yeah, well, that's from Faye, yeah. Oh, so, now I can't, I got doggone it all. This is not a speaker bureau. Shall I try to tell a dirty joke while I try to get my thoughts back together?
I'm coming in only for a second to get the heat off.
Oh, yeah, that's it. That's it. So, I was going to tell you about my physical condition prior to going to AA, just to illustrate that, hey, I needed this program. By the time I was 15, and that's the bit with the symptom thing. By the time I was 15, I'd been smoking and inhaling on cigarettes for 6 years. I was a regular barroom drinker. By then we had moved to New York. 18 was the thing, and nobody checked anything. I had been tattooed to prove how tough I was. And by the time I was 15, another thing is that I was arrested and put in a children's shelter, which was the first step to Elmira's reform school, for truancy. I never went to school. I flunked every subject of my sophomore year. I mean, you know, got a few things going there. And I ran away from home, and I never lived with my parents again. That was maybe the first best thing I ever did, because I hung around with a bunch of really... Today, if my children had ever brought anybody that even resembled the guys I used to hang around with, I'd have shot them, you know. Anyway, I ran away with a guy, Jim Kelly. And 10 days, we ran out of money, and he went home. And I said, I'm not going home. So I hitchhiked on up to this little town in New Albany where Faye McGee lived. And my grandparents lived. And I went to my grandmother's house. And I had worked on dairy farms because I spent summers up there. And so I had a job on a dairy farm the next day. $30 a month and found. Okay. And, of course, my grandmother let my parents know where I was. And I guess a couple of 3 weeks later, I had left home with a cardboard suitcase and with most of the stuff I needed, I guess. But they stopped by and dropped off more clothing, asked how I was doing, stuff like that. Probably glad to get rid of me. I must have been a real pain. But anyway, that was a good change for me, a very wholesome thing. There I was working with horses. Didn't have tractors. Had 600 acres. We were milking right around 50 head. And they did have milking machines, but we had to strip them in those days. In other words, finish them off after the milker couldn't get it all. And then anything we did, you know, like haying, oats, all that kind of stuff we did with horses. And they had these great big things, you know. Percherons, they were. We had three teams, and they were gray teams. I could barely see over their back. Well, I had started, as I mentioned, drinking in bars. Well, I was a city boy. I want to show these country kids, you know. But then they introduced me to hard cider. Whew! You know, it tasted so good, but all of a sudden, wham! And so I learned to nurse things, and I went through a few sick periods and things like that. Anyway, I went back to high school, and I finally finished 3 years in two, which wasn't too bad. I had a great teacher, Mr. Remba. I didn't find out until the last part of my senior year that you needed a language to go to college, and I was taking college preparatory courses. And I took Spanish 1A and 1B at the same time, and she tutored me nights for nothing, and by God, I passed. How about that? I went in the Marine Corps. I was drunk a lot. Drank it every time I could. Got out of the Marine Corps, went up to Syracuse University, and by the time I was 25, I was a daily whiskey drinker. Now, I was on a GI Bill. Tuition, believe it or not, for an entire term was only $650. How about that? I only got $800, though, for the term. I had to live. And I always worked. And anyway, I took 7 years to get a four-year piece of paper. And I had done pretty well with GE. I went to work for GE while working, while going to school. And I started out manufacturing, and then I went into personnel relations, union relations, and then public relations, which is a paradise for drunks. That's where I began to really notice problems, although, I don't know, I just thought, well, that's the way it goes, or I didn't think about it, or what. The first big blackout that I remember, how about that? Had a conflict in terms. I was supposed to give a talk at a Red Cross thing that night. And so I got there early at the lounge, you know, the bar at the Hotel Syracuse. And the next thing I know, I'm waking up in my trailer because I had lived alone. And I thought, wow. I wonder, and it's 10 o'clock. You don't need to go to office every day when you're in public relations. At least I didn't. I also cheated on my expense account. But anyway, I learned to ask the vague questions. So I called my good buddy Leo Legere, who was there. And I says, hey, Leo, that talk of mine last night. He says, yeah, I heard about it. What about it? You know, oh, good, I gave it. So here's the amazing thing, you know. Here I was in alcoholic amnesia, I guess you'd call it, a blackout. Apparently didn't stagger. I didn't slur my words. I was prepared to give a speech. And so here, amazing. Anyway, I have since learned, since I'm sober, that blackouts are hallmark to the diagnosis of alcoholism. I guess normal, whatever that is, drinkers, don't have them. Now, Leo, he was a drinking buddy of mine. He looked just like me when we were drinking. He's not an alcoholic. And another thing that I always noticed about him was that he would go about his business. He didn't let it interfere. I couldn't do that. I figured I was a lousy employee because I didn't go back to the office and I'm drinking on the expense account, you know. Anyway, I finally, GE had enough of me and they let me go. And I was unemployed and unemployable for a little over a year. And I was making $14,000 a year, which was big money in those days. I think it was something like 15 months of unemployment. I went through $15,000. You know, just, I don't know, just pick up and go. No sense. I had interviewed with the Secret Service in Syracuse and had two interviews with them. And apparently they passed my application or whatever. I get a call to meet this guy on a corner, and he gives me cash to come to D.C. I'm going to go to work for the CIA. they needed somebody right away. That was the big thing. It's like 3 days, something like that. And it was for something that I had learned how to do in the Marine Corps. So I worked on a couple of contracts, and then they took me on full-time before they ever did a background investigation on me. And, you know, if they'd have done that, they'd have known that they had a number one wash. Well, now that I'm employed, I figure I better get married. Actually, I don't remember asking the girl. That's terrible, isn't it? But my buddy Danny Dunham, another good, well, he's the guy that helped me light matches, you know, with the same McGee. Anyway, where was I?
Getting married.
Oh, yeah. You know, here I was, a guy that would wake up on the floor in the morning, plenty of times. Nobody would see it. I'd just suppress it. And all of a sudden, I married a girl, you know, with three children. Wow. I'm in the middle of this active family. And every time I turned around, there's somebody standing there looking at me. Oh, boy, I mean, that drove me nuts. I remember one morning, I would get up early, you know. I was an early morning person. Of course, I really am. But I was really getting up on weekends, you know, to have a drink. And I had the bottle up, and I hear, "Good morning, Daddy." And I turn around, and here's Katie, blonde, blue-eyed, peaches and cream complexion, you know, innocent. Oh, I felt so dirty. Incidents like that started. Well, my last day of drinking, and I didn't know it was going to be my last day, of course, I woke up and my family was missing. Again. I was a daily whiskey drinker, but went on binges, and when that happened, people disappeared. And anyway, I was put out, not that they, you know, I didn't care, you know, I wasn't worried about them. But I was put out that day because I wanted to go to the internment, I guess you'd call it, of a buddy of mine that I'd served with in the Korean War. He was being buried in Fairfax Station. It's a very famous church, by the way, St. Mary's Catholic Church. It was a field hospital for the first and second Battle of Manassas. Anyway, I showed up there. They had lived in Richmond, and the service had been up there. They were just putting them in the ground in Fairfax Station. And so I showed up, and there were, I don't know, six or seven people, maybe some pallbearers. I know there was a priest. And I don't know whether it had rained or it had frozen and thawed, but you know how slippery the ground gets around here, that soil that looks like clay and really is. I had on a white raincoat that day, by the way. And I got one leg too close, and I slid down in there, and I'm hanging on. And as I thrashed around, my white raincoat was getting redder and redder. Somebody pulled me out. And, of course, everybody didn't want me to drive. But, boy, when I drank, I drove. And so I got in the car. And I headed down 123 towards Fairfax. And I looked off to my left, and that was open fields in those days. And I saw this brand-new police station they had just built. And I said, I ought to report my family missing. So I went in there to report my family missing, and they locked me up for being drunk in public. Best thing ever happened to me. Spouses know how when the coast is clear, because when I was allowed finally to make the call, Marilyn answered and came down and bailed me out. But before she did, she exacted a promise on the phone. Got to go to AA and get sober, or I'm taking the kids and leaving. And I knew she meant it. And besides, she was going to let me rot in jail. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. That's the 23rd of December. On the way home, I had a drink from under the seat. No intention of stopping drinking. But my binges made me pretty sick. I was done. And on the 24th, I was a real mess. I'm coming apart now. I still had a couple of drinks that I could keep down after a while. And I was shaking and everything else. I was really sick. So on the 24th, she didn't push it. On the 25th, she says, hey, you got to go. Well, I had come down in the morning, Christmas morning. Nice tree, all decorated. Presents under the tree. Some of them from Dad to the kids. I hadn't provided anything. Now, you know, drunk or not, I had some feelings, even then. So anyway, but I'll tell you what, the denial was working. I decided, by God, I'm going to call AA today, because on Christmas Day, they're going to be closed. And thank God AA is, you know, that holidays, sunny days, rainy days, every day. They're going, and we're going, and I'm glad. Anyway, my first meeting was at the Falls Church City Group. They couldn't find anybody. They usually picked people up in those days. There weren't that many of us around. In fact, I think in Northern Virginia at that time, I'll bet there weren't 20 meetings. I bet there's 4,000 of them up there now. I don't even know, but that's a lot. I got within three blocks of the church. Now, the church was the Episcopal Church. It's called the Falls Church, which the town is named after, because George Washington, coming from Mount Vernon to go to the falls, and, you know, that's how it got its name. I'm three blocks away, and I stopped at a motel, and they told me, well, you turn left, turn right, and you're there or something. And believe it or not, I couldn't retain the directions. So they put them down on paper, okay? And I followed and found the thing. I was kind of surprised. I expected to see a bunch of guys in old army overcoats, you know, and stuff like that. And hell, they had suit and tie and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't like the meeting, though, because that was an anniversary meeting where it had about six people celebrating, and they were all standing up there. Each one talked for a few minutes, and I didn't relate to any of that. All I wanted to do was get the hell out of there, and I headed for the door. And a big, tall electrician, Bill Westmoreland, great guy, still sober. He's got 48 years now. Lives down in Florida. I'm still in touch with him. He said, they used to call me Wild Bill, but it's Sweet William now. Anyway, he stood in front of me and shoved a scalding cup of coffee in my hand and a conditioned reflex, you know, I grabbed it and I was stuck. And he started talking about alcoholism being a down elevator. You can get off at any floor. You can ride it to the very pit down there, and that's an early grave or a trip to the insane asylum or being incarcerated the rest of your life, you know? And I knew that, boy, old Bill, he needed AA. He had to be a real alcoholic, that guy. So just to get rid of him, I promised to meet him at a meeting the next night. No intentions of going. The next day, in my sick thinking, I said, you know, if I don't go to that meeting and see Bill, he might get drunk, and he really needs it, you know. So I went to my next meeting, and that was a great meeting. That became a Fairfax meeting, became my home group. And it was a closed discussion meeting. In those days, at least in Northern Virginia, all discussion meetings were closed, and all speaker meetings were open. And boy, at those speaker meetings, they had a feed. And I'm telling you, a lot of times the guys in there, you know, were getting the best meal of their day that day. And it was, when you went to a 12-step to an alcoholic's home, you really looked like an alcoholic's home, you know what I mean? But anyway, I went to that. Everybody's introducing themselves and saying, I'm Charlie, I'm an alcoholic, Susie, alcoholic. Came around to me and I says, my name is Dave, and I choke on the word alcoholic. I'm still thinking of Faye McGee. And I said that, you know, and it patted me and said, keep coming back. And, you know, I liked the people, though. And when my brain cleared a little bit, and as I went to meetings, I heard a little bit from this one, a little bit from that one. And I said, you know what? These people have been where I was at the time. Boy, oh boy, that was important. I'd had plenty of well-meaning people tell me, hey, you got to do something about your drinking. Well, they didn't understand. It's talking down to me from up here. But in here, we're eyeball to eyeball. That's what really did. No teachers, no pupils, you know. Everybody's even Steven. We're all one drink away from our next drunk, period. Even me. One of the big shocks of my life was to have a good friend of mine with 30 years go back out. My God, I couldn't believe it. He was dead in something like 3 weeks. I wouldn't last that long. I believe that alcoholism is progressing within me today. My organs are older. I can't handle alcohol. And I wouldn't last a week. I'm positive of that. Anyway, I finally said, I'm Dave and I'm an alcoholic, and it was a big applause. And I was given the church key, and I had coffee duty. And I had not only to set up for the discussion meeting, but a large speaker meeting. You know, they set up 60, 70 seats. Now, whether they were filled or not, that's another one, but we had it. And also they had smoking in those days, so those dirty ashtrays to clean. And in the a lot of the discussion meetings, the smoke would hang in ribbons, you know. When I was smoking, I stopped smoking 13 months after I stopped drinking. And those two best things I've done for help. Anyway, I finally started understanding what was going on in here. And I heard about the steps. And then that's where Lou Sherwood came into my life. And I didn't ask him, but we had been friendly. And another thing was that there was a sociability after the meeting. We all went to this, I can't think of the name of it, you know, and we'd have coffee and key lime pie, hang around till midnight talking, you know. And Lou was always there. One night, I know when it was. Jeez. I just accessed that part of my brain. I know it's in there. Everything I've ever seen, touched, smelled, I know it's written here, but accessing is a real problem. Now I can't remember. Let's see. One night, a lady, a really nice lady, I'm just going to give you the way I heard it, okay, and the way it meant to me. And let me say this, that I'm still in protracted withdrawal. I went into acute withdrawal and post-acute, both. And it lasted for almost 9 months. I felt awful. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I had a headache, and I wanted to crawl up in a ball. The meetings at in Northern Virginia were 8:30, okay? Anyway, this woman, she said, and this is the way I heard it,
she says, when you stop drinking, the first thing that comes back is the physical part, and then the emotional part, and we work on the spiritual part for the rest of our life. And I said, bullshit. I was hurting.
Lou gets me after the meeting. He says, have you got a doctor? Family doctor? I'm, sure, for the kids. I don't go, but, you know. He says, see if he'll give you vitamin B12 and vitamin B complex shots. God, I can't tell you. And I took him to work to the nurse, and she shot me. And, man, I'm telling you, I snapped right out of it. All I needed was a little bit of help there. Even though I was eating healthy foods and everything, apparently I wasn't able to take it in. As a result, Lou says, I'm going to be your sponsor. And so that started a relationship that was really great. And he was on the list for the Fairfax City and Fairfax County Police. Anytime they got a drunk in their jail, they'd call Lou, and then he'd call me after I came in, and we would take whoever it was to 6th and N Street down in 4th and N, 5th and N, 5th and N, in D.C. It was a detox. It was the only thing, there weren't any treatment programs in those days. It was before the days of treatment programs. The passage of the Hughes Act, Public Law 91616, which created all of the treatment, all the money to have treatment programs, mandated that all government agencies start programs, created the NIAAA, National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and it was called the Hughes Act because Senator Hughes was an AA. How about that? That's neat. Anyway, we'd take him down to the detox, and quite often we would have to stop and buy a cheap bottle of wine to keep the guy from going into, you know, DTs or something. And I remember one time he got a little too much wine, and when we got there, he didn't want to go in, and boy, we said, yeah. Anyway, wet drunks would show up at AA meetings, and they were welcome. They were nicely controlled. They couldn't take over the meeting. And as a result, one night at the midnight meeting in Herndon, I saw my first alcoholic convulsion. Wow. Scary. I guess they resemble epileptic fits. I mean, kicking and everything else. And it scared the hell out of me. And you can actually die in them. Alcoholics die coming off booze. Drug addicts never die coming off. They die in overdoses because of the pyloric sphincter muscle between the intestine and the stomach. When you drink alcohol, it becomes irritated and closes, and the stomach will only absorb alcohol. It's not digested or anything into the bloodstream slowly. Okay. But if it gets by there, which happens sometimes when the college kids are chug-a-lugging and all that kind of stuff, and it gets into the intestine, then the alcohol, which is a poison, is absorbed as quickly as it's received. And it's such a shock to the heart that a lot of people die. Anyway, I don't know why I wanted to prove that. Lou, with picking up new people, he'd say, take so-and-so to the meeting, you know, tonight. And I'd pick them up. A lot of people didn't have cars, you know, and lost them or whatever. And so I started taking this one guy, and I became a sponsor. And I had about a year at that time. I was, at that time, on the fourth step. I'd like to talk about the fourth step. Very simple layout in the big book on how to do that fourth step. Boy, it can't get any more simple. You know, I have a BS degree in business. I took 2 years of accounting. I didn't understand that. You know. Anyway, Lou says, oh, yeah? He says, you ever done anything that made you feel bad? I said, sure. He said, write it down. So that's the way I started the fourth step. I'd start to write down something that bothered me. And I'd say, you know, that isn't what happened. That's that damn story I invented for public consumption, displaying away a black eye or a dented venom, whatever the hell it was, you know. Well, and said, so peel away to get to the truth. And because I was only doing the deficit side, the liability side, I really began to feel very low. Let me put it that way. I wonder, what else am I going to find out about me that isn't so? What a phony. Get this big facade up. About that time, I heard, we carpooled a lot. I learned a lot and got a lot out of the not only making coffee. I'd like to mention that, by the way. Plenty of times in those early days, God, I've got to have a drink. I'm putting it off 5 minutes at a crack. Geez, I can't do it tonight. I've got to set up and do the coffee. That's important. Anyway, now, where the hell was I? I have these little things. I can't...
You were in a car.
What?
No, you were in a car. You heard something.
Oh, yeah, right. We carpooled. And I learned a lot from my contemporaries. And we would go to a meeting and say, this ever happened to you? And we were swapping stories and things like this. And we would actually assign each other questions. You see somebody who looks like he knows what's going on. Ask him this. Okay, you know. We come back and compare notes on the way home. We all stayed sober, by the way. All four of us. I'm the only one that's still living, sadly. Anyway, I started sponsoring. And, I want to finish the fourth step. Having done the fourth step to the best of my ability, and I heard while carpooling about assets, I said to Lou, I says, hey, I've been writing down all these liabilities. I said, what about the assets? He says, are your assets bothering you? And I says, no. He says, keep on doing the liabilities. So I didn't have any of the assets things in there. Well, then the fifth step, you know, another human being to God and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Two things I was never going to tell anybody, including Lou. So we get into the fifth step, and it wasn't me just the regurgitating continuously. He was chiming in, and it wasn't who can top this or anything like that. And he came out with something, and I thought, whoo. I had him up here on a pedestal, you know. And I knew that Lou was a very productive and contributing member of society and a high-class guy and all this, you know. And he did that. And I blurted out those two things. And I'm so glad I did. Because I believe that our secrets keep us drunk. And hopefully whatever you're looking at here tonight is really day-free, right? I hope so, too. Anyway, I started sponsoring, and that was great. I got the certain ego thing out of that. Until, I can't remember I do remember his name, Fred. Fred was a slipper and slider. And not only that, he was a physical guy. He would, punch holes in the wall, actually push his wife around. He was a danger to himself and others when he was really drunk. And his wife would always call me, and I'd go over and I'd wrestle him a while and quiet him down and all that kind of stuff. He was in pretty good shape then. And anyway, I did this a few times. The last time I did it, I didn't get there quick enough. The police had arrived, too, and I arrived about the same time. And he lived in an apartment, and they were out in the hall. And they say, you going in there? And I says, yeah, I'm going. We got a call. He said, we can't go in there, you know. He says, this is living room. And I said, well, you know, he's really a danger to himself and others. I said, you can't give me a hand? I said, look, they got a law against entrapment in this state, but if you can get him out here in this hall, his ass is mine. You know, and I thought, oh, well, okay. So I hustled him out there, and they put him in a straitjacket. And this was right about the time that they had passed the Hughes Act. And hospitals were not, at least Fairfax, had not yet started a program. They weren't admitting alcoholics. This guy didn't have a doctor to give him a phony diagnosis and stick him up in a psych ward and then, you know, detox him. So the guy just kept reading a prepared statement. He said, you can take him home, where he was a danger to himself. You can let the police have him, where maybe he'd die in their jail. Or you can take him down to Western State. Well, good God, that's what? 80, 90 miles from Fairfax. And so I finally talked his wife into letting the police have him. Then I laid awake all night hoping he didn't die, you know. That all changed, you know. Fairfax has a very good program these days, Fairfax Hospital. But that was some of the experiences of the early days. One other thing on, I don't know what you call it, I guess it's 12-stepping in a way. We had a guy that was really a good egg. And he finally got sober, too. And I can remember Lou and me, a couple others, going over with a bottle. And we weaned him over the weekend so he'd get to work on Monday morning. And that was pretty cool, you know. I thought that was really something. And it was. Anyway, that's the way that was then. Now we have, thank God, we have treatment programs and hospitals that will accept us, you know, instead of the other way around. I love AA. I love the people in AA. I know the cynics say, if you love everybody in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. Oh, yeah? I'd be willing to bet I've gone to 6,000 meetings, okay? And I love everybody in AA. I might not like what you say or maybe what you're doing, but I love you. And you know why? Because you've been exactly where I've been. I don't care whether it was in a gutter or was in some fancy living room. You know, I never got to Skid Row, but by God, I took Skid Row into my living room every night. You know? Yeah. And it's the AA people, I keep going AA. A lot of my contemporaries came in when I did. They don't go anymore. I talked to some of them. They say, well, same thing over and over. I said, oh, really? You must get tired of seeing miracles. Because, boy, every AA person in here that's sober is a living miracle. I know there was no power on this earth that could have stopped me from drinking. And while I'm talking about that, I'm going to close. Because of my family background and things, I turned away from anything religious. Okay, I'm still not a churchgoer. But I believe that in AA, in the first year, I had a spiritual awakening. And I remember going to a minister, making an appointment and seeing him, to find out whether or not I was kidding myself. And I told him, well, you know, AA and this and that. And fortunately, he happened to know a lot about AA. And here's what he said. Here's what I remember he said. I don't know if he said this. He said, you know, he said, I think it's very possible that you've had a spiritual awakening. He says, you know, he says, we members of the clergy spend a lot of time on ecclesiastical exercises and not enough time on the nitty-gritty of everyday living like you do in AA. And, you know, we have a really nice, unthreatening way of saying, I like that thing, God as I understand him or we understood him. I guess the person that put that in there was an agnostic, I don't know, or an atheist. I don't know. But, boy, that was important to me early on. And, you know, I remember when Lou told me to pray. Pray. Anyway, I didn't want to pray. One Sunday in the afternoon after meal, I went in the bedroom, and as Lou told me, I got down on my knees, and guess what? I was embarrassed. I said, what the hell am I doing here? That's how far I had to come from, you know. I didn't believe in anything to speak of. I do today. I call him God because it's easier to say. It's really my higher power. And I probably have a different view of my higher power than you do. But I'll tell you what, the higher power ain't me, I know that. And I want to thank everybody for being attentive. I don't have any real good way to close this other than just shut up and sit down.